Welcome back to the Plumbify podcast. I know it's been a while, but I'm really excited to have my friend and mentor, Ryan Gazzard, join us. Ryan's an industry enthusiast, advisor, thought leader, and performance coach within the residential building construction sector. Ryan is also a wellness ambassador for the Master Builders of South Australia Rise program. Thanks again for joining us, and I think you'll really get a whole lot of value out of this podcast. Hope you enjoy. All right. On the podcast today, I've got Ryan Gazzard, and I'll do an intro to you, Ryan, like I said, but thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. You have had a really, really diverse career, and I think just for, to start with, could we just touch on, if you could just touch on your career and how you ended up here to sort of where you are today?
Sure. Well, I left school in year 11, end of year 11, because school really wasn't a good fit for me, and went into hardware and started at Mitre 10. Lucky enough to blue light on, so
you're all good, keep going.
Got picked up into a management apprenticeship through Stratco, who acquired the business I was working for, and for many years just went on a growth trajectory through the sort of corporate world in business. Spent some time in South Australia and in WA. I'm setting up a division of a business called Elgas in WA. And if I fast forward to 2006, I've come back, become a bit restless, and wanted to do something different. It was that point in time when I sort of entered the construction sector, so almost 20 years ago. And what actually got me into the sector was partly because my dad's a builder.
Yeah.
But me and my brother didn't go down that track because we were just exploited as cheap labor as kids, and I think that we were tarnished, so we didn't go down that track early. But I always had a passion for the industry, I think, just being in and around it and living in a house that was always a construction site. And then secondly, having spent a lot of time in sales, marketing and retail, as I was looking to buy a house myself and we were walking the streets, walking through display homes, I was really quite underwhelmed by what I was, how I was being served, what the industry was offering, and sort of spiked something in me. I thought, wow, I really feel like I could, make a difference given the opportunity. And whether it be fatal or what have you, an opportunity shortly after came up with AB Jennings for state sales and marketing manager. And long story short, I was able to be awarded that role, and partly awarded it because they were probably looking for something different, and I was different because I hadn't had any experience in the industry, whereas everyone else that they had previously had come from doing a similar role working for another builder. I think they were just, it was just perfect coming together. If I was looking for a new challenge, I had a different skill set to what they've been used to, but they were looking for it because their business was losing market share and they really felt like they needed some fresh ideas. And, that was where I started my career. And to be honest, it's been an amazing journey over the last sort of 18 years. It's taken me from AB Jennings, both running state and national business for them in sales and marketing. Got procured through Sekisui House that bought that business in 2009, and spent a couple of years working for a Japanese CEO, which was interesting. I liken probably the Japanese experience to probably the greatest growth period of my life.
Yeah.
Japanese, Australian, they were two different countries. We work very differently. We build homes very differently. Culturally, we're very different. And I was, responsible for, 250 staff nationally. And my counterpart had the other 250. And we had to take, we had to take not only the brand from AB Jennings to Sekisui House, which was somewhat challenging.
Yeah.
But we also had to build a hybrid culture. And so we had to get a national workforce to believe in this hybrid culture, that what it looked like on a day-to-day basis was that around the whole country, someone would get up every morning and read from a little prayer book called Love of Humanity. Now, if I think about that now, I just couldn't imagine how we ever got them to do that. But they willingly, someone every day in the office would get up in front of their peers and read a passage from a little book that would fit in their pocket called Love of Humanity.
Yeah, and this was brought in from the Japanese side of things, is that what
you... It was an acknowledgement at a senior exec level that we needed to find a way of coming together that wasn't going to be Japanese and wasn't going to be Australian. We needed to come up and create our own lane.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the byproducts of that. But what was most inspiring about it is we were able to get a workforce to believe that, you know, finding this hybrid culture was a good thing and getting people on board with that.
Wow.
That journey finished in 2012 and I went and I jumped into bed to the land development side for a while, and partly with Lendlease, and part of that was that I was really quite frustrated in the building industry, where the land development side of the urban development side always just seemed like so difficult to collaborate. So I did that for a couple of years, and then from there I've consulted most of my career from then, so about 2014, having moved in and out of running building companies though through that period. So occasionally some of my clients that I feel quite passionately about will say, look, you know, we'd love you to come in and, you know, take over the reins for a period. And so I've gone in and out of doing that now for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
But more recently, over the last 12 months, I've made a real decision to not do that anymore. I advise a much smaller number of clients, but what I'm really focused in today is working amongst a group of circles of progressive minds and how we, you know, build some energy around some of these massive rocks that we need to move at an industry level. And now I work very holistically across the industry. It gives me a clearer opportunity and vision around where those obstacles are.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not something that with my own hands I can change, but I do work now amongst a number of different groups of people that are, you know, coming at this with the same level of energy and excitement as I do about how do we collaborate together and work towards trying to, you know, move this industry forward as a whole.
Well, actually, that leads perfectly into my next question. I wanted to get you like from a high level point of view, where do you think we're at in the building and construction industry? Because like we hear about all the issues like national housing crisis, national skill shortage crisis. And I'd be interested to know, like, what's your thoughts on how we ended up here? And maybe like also, what do you think are the fundamental things we need to be looking at to get us out of this pickle that we seem to be in?
No, it's a really good question. And, you know, most of the rhetoric that's, you know, served up through the industry, you know, some of that is quite obvious. We talk about skill shortage. I mean, part of that is our own doing. As an industry, we've never been great at succession and training and learning and development as vis-a-vis other sectors. But we've also taken our eye off the sector in relation to building that future resilience in our workforce, you know, doing obvious things like shutting down the tech schools back in the mid-70s and really never have clawed that back.
Yep.
We're just starting to mobilise a strategy around that now by opening five tech schools in South Australia. So definitely the capability within the workforce is definitely an issue. What is less topical is that most people don't realise that the workforce we think about is being the people on the ground, building the houses. But in fact, 70% of the workforce is pre-construction capability. So it accumulates roles like estimating and design, engineers, contracts administration, accounts. That actually makes up 70% of the cost of most building companies. And in that area as well, we've got a really depleted workforce capability. Fundamentally, where our industry is really struggling though is we've had an underlying supply of housing for many years, or decades. So there's always been more demand for property than we've actually as an industry been able to build.
Yeah.
And part of that is that our industry is still very quite archaic. In fact, not much has really changed in the way we build.
Yeah.
In the last century, build you know, there's changes in things like materials and specifications and the look and feel, you know, things like trends change, but how we structurally build a house hasn't really changed. It generally relies on bringing over 100 stakeholders to one construction site to work collaboratively together to build a house.
Yeah,
we also only operate 170 working days on site, one shift.
The unproductivity is what was.
It's a massive
thing here, is
underlying issue.
Yeah,
and I think the third thing that fundamentally has really stifled our ability to step up to increase our output, if we move past labour constraints, is our industry for a long, long time understood that to scale we needed to build a lot of the same houses at repetition. And that de-risks business because you become very good at building the same widget 1,000 times. We used to call that project housing. And so probably 60% of all the houses in Australia going back, you know, 10 years plus, and for decades before, 60% of that housing was project housing. It was building the same house as many times as possible, which decreases the amount of risk of making error and mistake, becomes a lot easier to understand what the cost of building that house is. And the workforce capability are so familiar with what they're doing that there's less likely in the quality. So the quality is better. Over the last 10 years, one of the responses to trying to respond to a consumer that's becoming more agitated with our inability to evolve is we've just allowed them to actually just turn us all into custom builders. And so that's just changed the whole dynamic of our capacity to be able to build quality homes at scale. We're now, I liken it to the fact that we're now trying to build 180,000 plus homes across Australia, and they're all one-offs. And so if you just think about that and what challenges that throws our industry and the ability to be able to build quality homes at scale at an affordable price and to do them with speed and accuracy, I think fundamentally that's a real challenge that we have as an industry. And I think the very last part is we haven't evolved. So, you know, other economies around the world have moved into more industrialized types of manufacturing. And so we're talking about manufacturing that's done in factories like prefab and modular, where you can run shifts 24/7, you can bring in robotics and and really sound SOPs to be able to deal with quality. And it becomes more of an assembly thing on site. But the output in some countries like Japan, where I've had the opportunity to go to many times working for them, they can build 180 to 200,000 homes out of two factories a year. Well, we're trying to do that across nearly 40,000 registered builders across Australia. So, you know, some of these things are not easy to fix. But, you know, the reality is what we've looked upon for a long time is the builders to come up with the solution. For the top 200 builders, they probably don't really want to change because, you know, builders in isolation are quite selfless. They want to just do what's right for their business, which is fair enough. They're making decisions that are right for them. And for a lot of the smaller builders, you know, they don't have the business acronym. They've come from being a tradespeople and they don't have the business acronym to really think about, well, how can they make a difference and try and address these things. What we really are looking for is a bipartisan approach to how this whole industry can move forward. But I think we're at the point today where we recognize that the builders just need to keep doing what they do. And, you know, we need to create another pathway. And over time, some of the builders will start to move into that space. But I think what we see is this industrialization through modular and prefab is going to be the old project housing over the next decade, I believe. This is my view. I think we'll see probably 40 to 50% of all housing in the next decade will be built in controlled environments and assembled on site. And so what we'll get then is we'll still have traditional stick form builds, but we'll be doing less of them. They'll be left to more boutique and custom high-end builds where we get the true masters of trade that are building those beautiful homes, and the rest of it will be built in modular type environments.
Oh, mate, there's so many things I want to touch on that you just spoke about them. But
with a mouthful.
But no, I'm glad you said a lot of those things. So one of the things I've seen, correct me if I'm wrong, is that a new way of building, which they're talking about, which is like building like a micro... like micro factory on site, and it's like I thought you might have a little bit of insight into it, and I'm pretty sure they 3D print a fair bit of the house, but they create like a little factory almost on site, and then they move it to the next site. Is that a thing that is happening?
I've seen that. I don't think we've got any traction in that in Australia at the moment. I've seen examples of that happening.
And when you talk about I know you got quite an interest in the fact modular built in factories, and I remember you said a really good point to me that I'd love for you to touch on, which was that, the absolute lack of productivity we have over here because we got like adverse weather conditions all the time, you know, four-day work weeks happening, RDOs, like, and it just creates this huge unproductivity or lack of productivity. But in these factories, there's some, you know, it's a controlled environment. Some of them are running like, are they running like 24/7 almost?
Correct. Yeah. They're running 24/7, you know, 300 and 60-odd days a year.
And are we doing that here currently? Is it like in
Australia? There's a couple of companies that are really emerging. There's one in particular that I feel is a standout called Modscape.
Okay.
Who have an operations up the eastern states, and they've just more recently opened up their new factory in Victoria, which is, I'm told, speaking to the CEO there, it's the size of the MCG as far as the footprint. But they're really starting to lean into robotics and the likes, which is all about driving efficiency and quality control.
Yeah,
you know, one of the most emerging modular businesses that I'm aware of at the moment is actually coming out of the automotive. So even Toyota has interests in modular, because I think when you think about it, building a car and building a house, there isn't too much dissimilarity if you're thinking about it from a modular. If you think about it from a factory type environment, right? You need doors in houses, you need doors on cars, you need, you know, seats, you need all the, it's just a production line.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to reinvent that in Australia at the moment. But the reality is that most traditional builders aren't going to be getting that excited about it because they've gone to trade school, they've learned their craft, you know, to be a carpenter or to be a plumber or electrician. You know, the idea of, you know, they would might see that as simplifying themselves. I think the challenge is how do we transition some of that workforce, but also build in situ a new capability.
Yeah,
because at some point they will always coexist. But at the moment, we're trying to mobilize that existing workforce. Then they're not really listening and they're not really interested. And there's a lot of investment that has to come in to support this as well. I just think that we need to start thinking about, in many, many industries, they've become globalized.
Yeah.
And I think we're still thinking about little old housing problems here, as in we're Australia.
Yeah.
We need to be really thinking and looking upon who's got best practice and what can we learn and how can we potentially partner in some way to solve some of these problems so we can actually speed this machine up. It's the only way we're going to get anywhere near these targets that have been dreamt up of 1.2 million homes in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
We honestly, it sounds good and it's need it.
Yeah.
But the reality is there's no one that's in this industry that believes that's achievable under the current trajectory that our industry is currently on.
And like you said before, there's a lot of these huge home builders. Like how are we going to incentivize them to bring up, like, to sort of drive some of these changes? Because like you said, a lot of them just would have no real incentive. They don't want to change. They already got, you know, good business models or a huge portion of the work that's out there. So they don't have a lot of incentive to actually want to change either.
Correct. So if you took, you know, a sample of, you know, the top 100 builders in Australia, and that might represent 40,000 of the 180,000 homes that we build in Australia, it's hard to imagine that going and sitting down with those big brands, I won't mention them, but, you know, we probably all know who some of these big national builders are. I've worked for some of them. It's hard to imagine a conversation that looks like stop doing what you're doing over here and transition into this. And this is where I believe that we need to be thinking about how do we build alongside that a different capability. A manufacturing capability isn't reliant so much on people, you know, having all the same skills.
Yeah.
Yes, you still need to have a certain amount of skills. You still need to have plumbers and electricians that are signing off and COCs and all this sort of stuff. But a lot of the manufacturing side of things that have been done in a controlled environment, they're just done by a labor force.
Yeah.
But there's a different skilled labor force.
Yeah.
And so I think we can lean into other sectors. We used to be one of the biggest manufacturing countries, whether it be white goods and automotive. We've proven to ourselves we're good at manufacturing. We just need to start thinking about how we lean back into that capability, but from a housing point of view, residential housing point of view.
Yeah, well. So I suppose that passive homes, I've got a real interest in, like, you know, that passive homes sort of piece. And I think we've had chats about it before. I'd love to get your thoughts on, you know, where we sit on looking at, like, the value of how we're going to incentivize, I suppose, the consumer to want to pick the more expensive house that initially off the, you know, sign the contract, it's $500,000, but the house that's so much more effective over the lifespan of the house, 30, 40 years or whatever, is $200,000 more because it's like a passive build. It's got 7-star energy ratings. What do we need to do as an industry to sort of uplift that and create incentives for the consumers to actually want to build those sort of homes. They're going to get us to these 7-star energy ratings and all these things that seem like a dream.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. And first, we've got to get rid of this word incentive, because we keep blowing up our industry by just giving out freebies.
Mm-hmm.
What we actually need to do is start properly educating our customers. And one of the fundamental reasons why this is a problem is because traditionally builders are not interested in what the home and how the home performs once they hand over the keys. Mm. So a builder's interest stops at home handover or practical completion.
Yep.
They have no skin in the game other than statutory requirements around maintenance, which generally the builder's view is get the consumer in that home and get out of there. Because anything more than that is just margin erosion through defects.
Yeah.
So there's no skin in the game that the builder has whole of life for the consumer. So what that ultimately means is that even though everything you said is could be factually correct, that we should be thinking about the consumer and how that home is going to perform and what the cost of that home is going to look like, the builder doesn't think like that. So what that ultimately means is the consumer has zero education on this at all. There's very few builders, especially in volume, that are interested in opening up a conversation with the consumer to say to them, how about you don't put that extra 20 square meters into a fifth bedroom that you probably won't occupy, and we put that into the right glazing outcomes, the right passive home outcomes, the right smart home technology. With the money that you're not spending on that room, we can reinvest that into things that's actually going to make your home smarter, more thermally efficient, more passive, and cheaper to run at a more livable.
Yeah, yeah.
I would argue that I'm not aware of any conversations like that largely take place. And I know that I've been part of that problem myself, because I've lived in the institutions that narrated what sales teams would say nationally, and it didn't include any of that.
Yeah.
But if I step back now, realizing that I've been part of the problem, I'm big enough to say that that's the case. You know, self-interest, running a building company, you're only thinking about what's best for that building company.
Yeah.
But if I step outside of it now, we should be changing the narrative to be thinking about not incentivizing the consumer, but incentivizing the builder to change the narrative at the start, so that we are incentivizing the builder to build homes that are going to make those homes more livable, more energy efficient, and more cost effective for the people and the occupants of that home in the future.
Yeah. So it's like it might be thinking about, from a holistic point of view, shrinking some of the houses but making them more efficient, and looking at it from a perspective whereas the builder's not losing money on the, you know, because they've took out 20 square meters, but, you know, because they're reinvesting it back into glazing air cons, which the builder is going to make a margin on anyway, I suppose. So,
well, it's largely education, because I've proven this on so many instances that if I was having a conversation with you at the early point, and you were a friend and came to me and said, Ryan, you know, I'm looking to build a home. I mean, everyone wants, you know, what they want.
Mm.
But if I can educate you into what the benefits are before you even start designing your home, around investing into certain things that are going to make your home far more livable and cost effective, and future-proofing it almost with the smart technology piece that's around today. And instead of thinking that you're having to spend that money, you're just making more sensible decisions about where do I invest my money? Do I build a house that I'm only going to occupy half of it?
Yeah.
Or do I just trim off a small percentage of that that I'm not going to use anyway? It's going to get the dust, and reinvest the same budget into different practical solutions that are thinking about more than just what it looks like when we move in, but more about how the home's also going to perform.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I want to switch it to, I guess, because you do a lot of business consulting and predominantly in the building industry. I'd like to understand, Ryan, if you were to think about your philosophical way of doing business, could you summarize it as in, like, you know, for you, is it, I guess it's a mixture of things, but, you know, are you sort of like really passionate about the people side of business, or the numbers, or like, if you could think about holistically how you look at business as like a CEO, how you've been a CEO, could you summarize how Could you summarize that?
I mean, look, people is, you know, is it, a lot of people will say people, but I'll give you an analogy to just help give some context of how I think about people. When you are leading a business, your responsibility is to create a workforce that wants to go on a journey with you.
Yeah.
And I always liken this to, you know, having a canoe. You know, I've bought myself a canoe and I need these people who are my workforce team to hop in that canoe because this canoe is going to a destination down the road.
Yeah.
That destination can't get there by myself because it's all uphill. And so I need that team to get in that canoe and paddle with me.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is really making sure that your team understands where your business is and where the destinations you're going to. Then you need to inspire them to get into the canoe because not everyone likes canoes and not everyone likes getting in the water.
Yeah.
So you've got to give them the right motivations.
Yeah.
And some of that is giving them purpose mm-hmm. and direction and inspiring them to give them a reason to get into that canoe. But once you've got them in the canoe, you're only halfway there.
Mm.
Well, you're only a quarter way. You've still got to get them to grab an oar because without them paddling, you're not going anywhere either.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to get them in the canoe. You've also got to inspire them to paddle with you.
Yeah.
But then you also got to get them all to paddle together because if you've ever been in the canoe and everyone's out of sync, you sort of go around in circles. So I simplify it to the point that every time I'm leading a business, I need to create a very clear vision that people want to go on that journey with me.
Yeah.
I need to get them all in that canoe with me, grabbing an oar and paddling like buggery with me. Because no business that I've ever led or that I've ever spoken to can ever grow sustainably if it doesn't have a workforce behind it that is growing with you.
Mm-hmm.
And fundamentally, you know, businesses are far more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But I've never seen a business be successful long term without having a reasonably strong team of committed workers that want to go on that journey behind you as a leader.
Yeah.
So I'm very passionate about the people bit.
Yeah.
Most people engage me because they think they want to grow. And I think that's in itself is quite problematic because when people say to me they want to grow, they don't really know what they want to grow. And to be honest, in every instance that I get involved with the client, the last thing I do to start with is grower. Because what I actually want to do is make sure that their business is actually operating really in a capable state today.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the business has still got cracks in the foundation and it's doing $2 million a year and you want to grow by 50% in the next 2 years, if you're going to do that based on the capabilities that are already got cracks at $2 million, those cracks just get bigger.
Yeah.
And the risks in those businesses get bigger.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything becomes a lot harder. And that gets propped up generally by the owners or the leaders of those businesses just having to work harder. Mm-hmm. And that to me is not sustainable either.
Mm.
So the measure of success, I think, ultimately in any business is scaling it, if that's what you wish to do, but doing it in a way that actually offers financial prosperity as well.
Mm.
Because you can be twice as busy and make far less money.
Yeah.
So it's all about building for me. It's about knowing exactly the destination you want a business to go on and then reverse engineering the staircase that gets you there. And I think that's fundamentally the way I think about any business.
Yeah.
You need a plan, but you also need to know exactly what dot it is you're aiming for on the wall into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, businesses just blow like the wind.
Mm.
You know, the wind comes in from the east and they blow west and vice versa because they ultimately don't know what they're aiming for themselves.
Yeah.
So each day, they're just responding to the present as opposed to building a business with resilience that's focused on what it's aiming towards.
I love that. I love that. Mate, that leads bloody perfectly into my next question. I was going to, and you know what, this is a selfish question in a way because, you know, we talk a fair bit and I feel like it's a problem. It's a common issue that I see up across the board with a lot of people and a lot of the audience that listen to this would have the same problem. So I wanted to see if you could, I guess, just let me know what you think are the key traps that you see of the the typical trade business or building business that they fall into at trying to scale? Because I found that you touched on scaling a business before, and scaling a service-based business ain't for the faint-hearted.
Mm.
And could you think of some typical traps that people fall into when they're trying to grow a trade-based business?
Absolutely. Well, I think the number one is that they don't actually have a plan. And it sounds so rudimentary and sort of, you know, when people think about building, you know, a business plan, I think we can move past, you know, what I experienced growing up in my professional career, which is like a thesis of 100 pages thing that becomes a doorstop that no one reads.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about a very sensible planner that identifies where you're at and where you want to go and what are all the things that need to be done at the right chronological order to be able to get you where you want to be. So the majority of business that I, you know, have worked with, or even just conversations I have with small business owners, I'm very lucky to be a participant in the RISE program with the MBA as a coach. And so I'm talking to lots and lots of business owners and lots of small business owners. And fundamentally, one of the challenges they all struggle with is that they don't really know where they want to go and they don't really know how to get there.
Mm.
And I think that's okay, because the reality is that we are largely a trade-based sector.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't come from being a trade. You know, I've got no calluses on these hands. So I've come from a business school.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my best advice that I give anyone is that, you know, lean in to, you know, at someone that has a skill set that can complement you, that can provide you some business coaching to help give you some of the tools that you haven't acquired through your lived experience so far.
Yeah.
You can be the best tradesperson, but it doesn't mean you can be the best business owner and business leader. But as long as you've got people that are willing to learn and be challenged and apply things and continue to refine their business, then they're the ingredients of success.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be a little bit vulnerable where you open up the door like you have.
Yeah.
And say, look, I accept I don't know it all. And you look for people that can complement that with a skill set that might not be one that is one that you have yourself.
Yeah.
I've been very lucky. I've had amazing mentors in my career. And, you know, how did I get where I am? Largely by, you know, what I learned and what I was taught through the leadership and mentors that I had in my career. Not everyone gets that.
Yeah.
And being a small business owner is incredibly lonely, especially if you're a sole business director. Because who do you talk to when you know businesses aren't all smooth sailing?
Mm.
You know, they are constantly responding to challenges inside the workplace, outside the workplace, and things that are out of your control. And so, you know, having someone that you can talk to, soundboard with, that can complement those skills with a different set of skills, just to agitate out the right dialogue, can be immensely helpful for a lot of business leaders.
Definitely.
And it surprises me that nowhere near as many as I would expect ever lean into, you know, having a business performance coach or something like that, because it's no different to elite athletes. You know, You can be the best tennis player in the world, and the tennis coach isn't expected to be equal to them on the tennis court, but they're able to observe and put different skills through looking through a different set of lenses, but also not being in the present.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fighting all these fires, it gives you a different level of perspective to bring sanity to all of the conversations that allow to build those building blocks.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I think as small business owners, especially coming out of a trade, you know, I've fallen into traps of just thinking like, I should know this, I should know that. But like, what I've found is, especially from a leadership point of view, you know, I don't know how you feel about that, but I don't know about if some people are born leaders or not, but I think thinking about business leadership, like a lot of the stuff you have to learn the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't be, people I think get fall in the trap of being expected to know like, oh, if I've got a hire five people, I should know how to do that. If I've got to get rid of five people, like, but I feel like so much of this stuff is just runs on the board and making mistakes and learning from it. And yeah, like you said, when you can find someone who's been there, like I've rang you before and said, I've got this problem, and you can say to me, oh, look, maybe you should look at it from this perspective instead. And yeah, you can't see that perspective unless you've got someone who's been there and lived it, you know?
Correct.
So I think it's easy to get in that trap of expecting to know all these things, but you can't unless a lot of the stuff you just can't know how to deal with unless you've dealt with it before.
Correct.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, this isn't a plug for the MBA Rise program, but I think that, you know, what I'm most proud about that the MBA, led by Will Frogley, in conjunction with the South Australian government, have created this RISE program, which is fueled by a need to address issues around mental health in our sector, but coming at it a bit differently, where it's putting lived skills in front of people in need that are living in the present issues of their business, and giving them a mechanism to lean into to have conversations with people that have largely been there and walked those streets before.
Yeah.
So they can give them, you know, really good insight and feedback. And sometimes it's just a matter of just being able to listen.
Yeah.
And give someone the ability to just get, because they can't.
Definitely.
They don't want to take that home in a lot of cases. And they can't show weakness in front of their peers at work. So, you know, this gives a vehicle that allows people to engage into that program and try and lean into, you know, we've got 18 coaches in that program now with lots of different experiences. But it's the program's there to support all these small business people that don't have anyone to talk to and are looking to talk to someone that is largely probably walked the same road and can give them real life experience as like a mentor.
It is lonely out there, man. And we also use it for our EAP.
Yes, like, 100%.
Like, it's not just for business owners, it's for anyone, you know, even my lads and the girls in the office use it, you know, so I agree. It's lonely out there, so...
I just wanted to address the one question that we didn't, one point I didn't mention though about this leadership thing where you've mentioned about, is it a taught or a, I think we're always all learning as leaders. You know, when I go into a larger organization and we've got cultural issues, it's generally what I hear from the leadership team is that, you know, the culture issues are all their problem, as in all the subordinates within the business.
Yeah.
When in fact, confrontingly, what I tell them is that the issue is actually all their problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's the poor leadership and the willing to acknowledge that they're not doing a very good job in leading that is creating this poor culture and sentiment within their workforce that leads to poor retention and the like. So poor leadership drives a lot of negative cultural outcomes, which is incredibly bad for business.
Yeah.
Some people want to hear that and other people don't want to hear that. They're willing to push all that blame onto their workforce. I think the true essence of a great leader is someone that's willing to accept that they are in control of the culture within their organization. Mm-hmm. And so if their organization's culture is bad, it's not their workforce issue. It's that they've got a leadership issue in their organization.
That can be hard to stomach when sometimes you just got to stop pointing the finger and point it straight back at yourself, don't you?
Mm. Which is hard to do.
Yeah, it's hard to do.
Very hard to do.
Yeah.
But it's hard to move a business forward culturally if you can't start there.
Yeah.
Because if you're just going to blame everyone else, then fundamentally you're not taking responsibility for what's in your control.
Yeah. I love that. I just wanted to have a couple of last quick questions,
sure.
Ryan. And this is another one that probably, this a lot of this stuff stems from when we first caught up, so because I loved it so much. I'd just love to know if you've got any advice for, like, you know, business owners such as myself. That's why it's a selfish question, but hopefully it translates to the people listening and watching this. But for people out there who might be going through, like, a tough time in their business, you know, like, I think things are definitely getting tougher out there. Do you have any, you know, little like exercises or anything you could recommend they do just to get like a quick win, you know what I mean? Like that'll just give them some quick gains, whether it's a SWOT analysis or just something that you would initially point them towards as a good exercise to do?
It's a really tricky a really tricky thing to answer, only because every individual has got different skill sets, mm-hmm. and they've got different needs and they've got different wants. But what I would probably say is sort of like a generic response is, I'm a massive believer in personal growth. So it somewhat surprises me a little bit that people that are aspiring to outperform their competitors are investing so little in their own growth, in personal development, in listening to, you know, to broaden their skills and listen to the right content and read the right things, to be able to really lift their own or identify where their gaps are and try and fill those gaps with knowledge. So that's something everyone can do, right? There's a plethora of content. I'm a podcast kind of guy, or an ebook. I'm not really big on reading out of a book.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I take information in. But I would invest over an hour every day in looking to learn one thing
mm-hmm.
or multiple things from a different source or a different person, because it just rounds you out as a business operative. But I think that, you know, I know I'm a business consultant, a performance consultant, so I don't want this to come across like I'm making a plug for my trade, because I'm not. But I think we underestimate how important having a supporter that is there to help channel yourself and how to best fill some of those gaps and bridge those gaps, and using that then to build your own capabilities from. I think it's a misunderstood investment.
Yep.
People see this thing as a cost. When you go and get someone into your organization to advise, but I'd arguably say that if you get the right person, it's an incredibly sound investment that you're making in the future investment of your organization.
Yeah, I rate that so highly. And I guess lastly, before I did want you to speak, please, at the end, just to build theory in what you're doing now, because I'll get probably a million phone calls about it. So I'd rather you just explain it.
Sure, thank you.
And this question came from my mate Ben, who knows of you, and when he knew you were coming on today, and I think it's definitely relevant to a lot of people I know. So I feel like, you know, obviously since COVID happened and all this stimulus and incentives got brought into the market, I feel like there's, and I can just say from anecdotally, I've seen it with a million of my mates, there's been so many people who've gone from, you know, themselves to 20 people or whatever. And I just wanted to know, I feel like there's a lot of people who might be transitioning from that phase of like thinking about, they're going from growing at all costs mentality to then sort of like protecting and consolidating what they have, or potentially downsizing to sort of consolidate and protect their business that they've built.
Mm.
Do you have any advice on, you know, for people who might be finding themselves in that situation? Mm. Like, you know, I don't know if it's parameters to look at or advice on, you know, really around that, but I think there's a lot of people who are going through that right now.
No, I would agree with that.
From the full growth at all costs, like there's so many opportunities, to now like, oh, okay, I feel like there's a lot more competitors now. There's not as much work going on. How do you look at that?
It's a big one to unpack. I think, you know, I too get a lot of this, get pulled into a lot of this conversation with people that have opportunistically, which is completely appropriate. You know, there's been a uplift in the industry, quite an aggressive uplift. And so people have leaned into that, which is, you know, common sense to some extent.
Yeah.
But it's been done without much thought, and it's been done with not a lot of structure and fundamentals behind it.
Mm.
And the market's pivoted a little bit again, but this isn't, I think people feel a lot of shame, you know, when, you know, for instance, they might go through a really good patch where they have some growth and they invest in that growth by bringing in more resources and that. But businesses are incredibly cyclical in the fact that they're always needing to morph into the current conditions.
Yeah.
And it's easy for me to say, because I've worked in big corporations where, you know, you're always morphing and changing to those situations, but it applies to any business. The shape of what your business looks like today doesn't necessarily mean it looks like that tomorrow. And it's okay if you need to consolidate or shrink or grow. What's more important is that you're constantly in touch with the important mechanisms that make for a successful business. And one of those is you need to be profitable.
Yep.
And so profit comes from a number of different things, but a lot of people talk to me about growth in a one-dimensional aspect, which is they're just looking at top-line revenue.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with looking at that is that in many instances, a lot of businesses grow their top line and naturally believe that by doing that, they'll have more money in the pocket for their family.
It doesn't always work for that,
does it? In a lot of ways, it doesn't. And one of the reasons for that is because generally, if their operational foundation is not super strong and not geared to scale, the only way you can do more is just by throwing more labor.
Yeah.
And so payroll is generally your biggest cost center in every business.
Mm.
And so the real key to growth is scale. And the difference between growth and scale is the ability to increase your business output, but not decrease in the cost of doing business at the same percentage.
Yeah.
The difference there then becomes profit.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that comes back to what I said before. It's a trap, right? Because when you grow, generally to grow, you need to throw more resources at it.
Mm.
But the more primitive your operational capabilities are, the more labor you have to throw at it to plug holes. And so what you might find is that you might have been running a business of $2 million and a payroll of $500,000. So it might have been 25%. You're now at $4 million. And your payroll is actually $1 million.
Yeah.
So the percentage of your payroll to revenue has actually gone greater than what it was when you were doing $2 million.
Yeah.
Now, why is that? Generally, it's because the foundations within your organization are not set to scale, meaning that the only way you can do more is by just throwing more labor at it, as opposed to leaning into technology and better systems and processes that allow the businesses to scale without having to throw so much labor at the problem.
Yeah.
And throwing more labor at it actually just creates more risk as well, because, you know, being a people leader is not easy either. We've got a shortage, workforce shortfall of skills in the industry. So that's putting a lot of pressure on, if you want to grow your workforce, there's not many people to choose from.
Yeah.
And so you're having to pay overs, which puts even more pressure on your payroll.
Yeah.
So the challenge is, now I don't want to sit here and say that there's not, this should stifle your enthusiasm to grow, because growing a business sensibly can be an incredibly prosperous business. But what I'm also trying to suggest is doing it with your eyes shut.
Yeah.
Is very dangerous.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you do have aspirations to grow your business, you should first be making sure that your existing operation is watertight.
Yep.
And running at a real optimal level, because to grow it, if there's already weaknesses and fracturing in that existing core business, it will never get better.
Yeah.
As you get bigger, it'll just fundamentally get harder.
Yeah. So many little traps you can fall into, Ryan, trying to grow a business. I love it. Thank you for that. That's such good advice. Would you mind just telling us a bit about, I guess, what you're up to now, Ryan, with Built Theory? And because, you know, I can personally vouch for, I mean, we first connected through the Rise program.
Yes.
Which was huge. And then, you know, we have also worked with you directly, and it was massive. So I feel like this isn't a plug or a sponsorship or anything whatsoever. But I think, I just know there's going to be a lot of people that are going to hit me up afterwards. So would you be able to give a plug to your business, I suppose, and just let people know a little bit about, you know, what you do?
Sure. Yeah. Look, so I work across a number of different businesses, but my core business is Built Theory. And it, in essence, it really just goes to a lot of the stuff we've talked to today. We work as performance coaches and consultants. And so, you know, a perfect customer for me is someone that, you know, has already got a good business and, you know, is just looking to have a conversation around how to make it even better.
Yeah.
And, you know, There are things that are just non-negotiable for me in having relationships with, you know, certain businesses. I mean, I'm very much focused, as we've talked about before, on people and having a sense of maturity where we can talk about things that, you know, sometimes can make people feel, you know, a little bit tight at the chest. But the reality is that to build a really resilient business, you have to be some level of vulnerability. Because to learn and to accept that you don't know everything means that you have to be willing to accept that you have ability to grow and learn.
Mm-hmm.
And you've also got to be able to trust other people.
Yeah.
And accept that you don't know it all, and accept that it's okay that you don't know it all, and that it's okay that others can come in and fill some of those voids.
Mm.
So that's what we do. We tend to do work with clients longer term, because when we're building a roadmap for a client, you know, we're talking generally in 3-year cycles.
Yeah.
So we don't get in and work within that business every day, but we'll build a plan that we believe represents what that business's capability could achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And then we help guide them and mentor them through the process of executing that, building up their own internal skills, but also helping nurture them through that process, so that we don't just give them a blueprint and say all the best.
Yeah,
we say this is what we believe is a sensible roadmap to get you aligned to where you as a business owner want to be. It's not up for me to tell you where you want to be. You know that's for you as a business leader. I help you understand whether that's a sensible thing to be aspiring for, and if it is, then how are we going to get there? And then we hold your hand through that process to get you there.
Sick. Can you tell people how they get in touch with you?
Yep. Look, to be honest, the best way to get in contact with me is either through our website, builttheory.com.au.
Yep.
Or I tend to live in LinkedIn. most of my life now. So certainly hunt me down, Ryan Gazzard, on LinkedIn.
All right. That's Gazzard with 2 Z's. Thank you, Ryan. And honestly, mate, I really do appreciate your friendship and your mentorship for me. It's been huge, and thanks so much for coming on.
Great, it's a pleasure.
Thank you, mate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another Plumbify podcast. Make sure you follow us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, LinkedIn, and all the usual podcast platforms.